Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As a writer for BuzzFeed News, Ann Helen Peterson's portfolio runs wide. From covering Mountain West politics and anti-government protesters on one hand, to in-depth pieces on the student loan crisis and millennial burnout or the Me Too movement, she also writes stories on Hollywood scandals, celebrity, and pop culture trends in equal measure. Peterson is a media studies academic who has found a home in 21st century digital journalism. A native of the Mountain West and currently the senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News, Peterson received her PhD from the University of Texas, where she studied the industrial history of the gossip industry. She's the author of two books, a remaking of her dissertation titled Scandals of Hollywood, and her most recent book, Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Reign of Unruly Women, a series of essays on 10 women from Hillary Clinton and Serena Williams to Lena Dunham and Nicki Minaj, who are all, in their own way, nonconformist role models for their generation. She'll be speaking tonight at 5:30 in a lecture titled From Unruly Women to Millennial Burnout, The Politics of Popular Culture in the Digital Age. The lecture is free and takes place this evening at Tyrrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. Ann Helen Peterson is my guest today. Ann Helen Peterson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
As a senior culture writer for BuzzFeed, you have a really interesting beat because it really ranges from serious political reporting to cultural reporting to learning about, you know, everything from Indian voting rights to interesting candidates in the West, as well as covering people like Keira Knightley and Jason Bateman and all sorts of different things as well. How do you balance that?
You know, I really do think of it under this big umbrella called culture. So that helps me organize it in my mind, how I could like write a big profile of Beto O'Rourke, but then also write about Gwen Stefani's new Vegas tour. You know what I mean? And so to me, like things that we consume as people in America or globally, like whether that's politics or whether that's thinking about voting rights or celebrity gossip, like all of that, I can look at it. And the way that I approach these topics is like, oh, that's really interesting, but why, right? Like people say that all the time. That's an interesting thing, but why is it interesting? And I use the skills that I have as a former academic and using like PhD stuff generally to approach these topics and kind of disassemble them and get to the heart of what does make it interesting. I do have this curiosity that spans a very wide spectrum.
When you look at your writing from week to week, it's, say, in the summer of 2018, there was about five or six profound, interesting stories off the beaten track somewhat, covering the political campaign. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, there was Gwen Stefani. Was that just an outlet? Or was there something that sort of attracted your attention? Says, you know, I'm going to just drop this election for a week or two and figure this out.
Well, you know, the pieces, they all take me, I almost entirely write feature pieces. And what that means is usually around 6,000 to 8,000 words. And if you aren't a person who writes, that means that it takes about 20 to 30 minutes to read it. And sometimes I need a little break in between. And so that's when I'll be like, oh, I just want to write something that's 1,000 words and get that up on the internet. And like, it's kind of like a palate cleanser or something like that. But also, you know, journalists, especially feature journalists like me, like you're always planning forward. So I'm plotting, okay, so I'm going to do this big piece on, you know, the governor of Montana, who was considering, maybe still is considering a presidential
run. Steve Bullock.
Yeah, he's a really interesting figure. And I'm also going to do this big profile of Beto. But what if I also go to Vegas and do this profile of Gwen Stefani? It for me, changing registers helps keep me fresh.
You take an unusual path to where you are today, because I think most journalists start out as journalists and then they end up in academia.
Yeah.
You actually started in academia first.
Yeah.
How did you get into journalism? Was it a creative outlet to write or?
It's such a weird story. I would never, ever have imagined myself a journalist. I never took a journalism class. I was completely uninterested in like the high school newspaper, in part because I'm a shy person. And I think sometimes when you're doing a radio interview, people are like, you're not shy, you're doing an interview on the radio. But like, the idea of talking to other people is something that is effort to me, which I guess, you know, technically that classifies me as an introvert. So for me, when I was thinking, you know, during college and immediately afterwards considering graduate school, the most delightful thing was like, how can I spend all of my time watching movies and thinking about movies and movie stars and doing film studies, right? So I did my PhD in film studies and thinking specifically about celebrity, how celebrities are manufactured and consumed, looking back over the last 100 years.
That's a preparation for a certain type of journalism.
Exactly.
I think. Yeah.
Exactly. And the early things that I wrote, I had a blog on WordPress back when blogs were cool. And I really was seeking an outlet outside of academic writing to try and write about the things that were interesting to me. And that gradually transitioned to writing for a couple of online places. Again, this is while I was writing my dissertation. I just wanted to write about these movie stars that I was thinking about, but I wanted to write about it in language that was accessible to a broader audience. So like an example is I was looking at these old scandals of classic Hollywood, and the stories are so juicy, but also not just salacious. Like it's actually really, really interesting to think about why some scandals turned into real scandals that ended careers and why others, the stars could survive them and move on. And so I wanted to share that information. And as I started writing for online outlets, gradually for like a little bit of pay, you know, the first piece I wrote, I got $100 for, and I was like, this is amazing. This is the most money I will ever receive to write something. And I also became a professor and was teaching at a small liberal arts college in Washington State. So I was kind of just doing the writing online as a side hustle. And then when my academic options became fewer, basically the job market was really bad. And I looked around and I was like, oh, well, the side hustle could become my main hustle. And it just happened at that time that someone at BuzzFeed said, okay, can you write an article for us? And we came up with the idea of something about Jennifer Lawrence, who was very much in the zeitgeist at that moment. And I wrote, this is actually such a classic me story. So I wrote about Jennifer Lawrence, but then I compared her to three previous it girls, cool girls, Clara Bow, Carol Lombard, and Jane Fonda. And the piece was called Jennifer Lawrence and the History of Cool Girls. And it went incredibly viral. It was one of the first pieces that was long on BuzzFeed to go viral. And the editor-in-chief said, well, you just wrote your job description, which was write stuff like that, but also write what you write. And so I gave my last final, and I flew to New York the next day and started that life. But in the beginning, it was very much analysis and stuff that was very rooted in my research as an academic. And that gradually shifted to, you know, people in the newsroom were like, okay, now you need to go report on this. Like I was writing about TMZ, which is something I knew a ton about from my academic research. And they said, now you need to go find people who used to work at TMZ and get them to talk to you. I was like, no way. That sounds horrible. But they're like, nope, you need to go to LA, like go on LinkedIn, figure out people who had it in their job description, you know, all of that stuff.
So you got on the job journalism training.
Yes. I mean, I had to Google things like what is a lead, right? What is a deck? These things that are taught to like freshmen in journalism. But I went to LA. I met with these people. I felt like I was going to throw up most of the time. But I think what I realized gradually was that that was how I was growing as a writer and as a thinker, was doing things that made me scared and that were really challenging.
Well, after working in New York for a while, you decided, I'm going to head back to the West. What was the reaction to BuzzFeed to that? You're going to do what?
Well, I had been working at BuzzFeed for nearly 4 years at that time. And I'd proven myself, I think. Like both as someone who could produce a lot of work, because being an academic taught me to work all the time. And also someone who didn't need a lot of supervision. So sometimes I think the reason that you have people really close in the office is to make sure that people are all on the same page, you know, that sort of thing. But also, so there were some of my coworkers in my section were in New York, but my editor was in LA. So it wasn't as if me leaving would somehow like break up the entire system. And I had gone to Montana to report on the special election there to replace Ryan Zinke, who had just been appointed Secretary of the Interior.
This is the one where the sitting congressman, the now sitting congressman, body slammed a reporter.
This is true.
Yeah. June Forte, I guess.
Yes, June Forte. And I had volunteered to go out there because I was like, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Montana. This is my place. And ahead of the election, I went out there for a week and just drove all over the state. And it was just beautiful spring. It was early May. Montana is one of the most gorgeous places in the United States. And I was so happy. And, it wasn't just the landscape. It was that the reporting was easy for the first time in my life. And that was because, you know, growing up in Idaho, like, these are my people. And I can ingratiate myself to people by being like, I'm from Idaho. Right. So they had a more confidence in me to speak to me. And so I came back and I was like, well, post-election, post-2016, so much of this conversation has been about how do we miss this, right? How did we miss what happened in the middle of the country that would turn into Trumpism? And part of it was that these incredible cutbacks in journalism made it so that a lot of the national papers and magazines just didn't have the same sort of correspondence that were actually rooted in these communities. And that's exacerbated by the fact that a lot of these local papers also weren't reporting in as a robust way as previously. And so I was like, why not let me report on the West from the West? And since then, that has expanded in a lot. Like, so people say, like, what do you mean the West? Because to me, it's not California. We have people in California who know California, right? So, you know, I report all up and down the Mountain West, but also, you know, a little bit into the Midwest. I'm originally from Minnesota. And then I spent a lot of time in Texas. And Texas is similar to the Mountain West in a lot of ways. Texas is 10 states. So I can, there are some of the states that I am very well-versed in now, but
still, there's always another one to learn.
I know. Like, I haven't the top panhandle. That's one of the Texas states that I don't know enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been wonderful. And I just feel like I feel happy in a way that I didn't necessarily when I lived in, you know, a tiny, tiny apartment in Brooklyn.
You know, it's very interesting. In the 2018 cycle, you're reporting in the middle of the summer on voting rights in Indian country, which of course later became an issue in North Dakota when basically the legislature made it more difficult for Native Americans to vote in the election because they had to have an address and reservations that don't necessarily have addresses. So you're really doing some sort of groundbreaking reporting a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, and that story was so fun and important. And when I started thinking about it, it's on specifically about Native voting rights on the Navajo Reservation in the southeast corner of Utah, which is a really fraught area because you have the intersection of public lands and conversations about Bears Ears National Monument. And it's also a place that, you know, the Navajo actually hold the majority of people or the majority in the county, but it's been controlled by the white and very, very Mormon minority for pretty much as long as anyone can remember. And I knew going into that, you know, there's a lot of ethics involved with doing Native reporting and especially being a white person reporting on Native issues. And I wanted to collaborate with a Native reporter to make this into a much better story. And so BuzzFeed collaborated with High Country News and one of their reporters, Graham Brewer, who is actually out of Oklahoma City, is Cherokee. And we went down there and we had a photographer who was Navajo and who was with us for the entire week. And we just really spent a lot of time. And if you've ever been to this area, like, it is vast. You know, you spend a lot of time driving all over the Navajo reservation. And that, I think, was essential to actually illustrating one of our points, which is that it is prohibitive to have a lot of these residents to ask them to come and vote at the voting centers, because sometimes it can take like 3 or 4 hour drive to get from their ancestral homelands to different places. Yeah. So that to me is an incredibly important story. It's really hard in America to get people to care about voting rights, first of all, to care about Native issues, second of all. So how can you do both of those stories in a way that makes people who aren't used to caring about these issues understand this is so important? Like, you might not think this affects you, but it absolutely affects anyone who's living in America.
My guest today is Ann Helen Peterson. She's a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News and author. Her most recent book is Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Reign of Unruly Women. She'll be speaking tonight at 5:30 at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, a little bit earlier you were mentioning, you said, you know, I was really covering this election and I was just feeling, and this has been the topic that has sort of been your big topic, I think, of early 2019, is millennial burnout. What do you mean by millennial burnout?
Millennial burnout is a term I arrived at after trying to figure out why I could not get things done on my to-do list. This was after this recent midterm election. And I realized, you know, there were just things, simple things, really, like drop your boots off at the cobbler, like mail a package to a friend that I really wanted to mail. You know, these are things that most of them were high effort, low reward, things that just stayed at the bottom of my to-do list and cycled over week after week after week. So originally I was like, I'm going to write a little bit about this. Like, what's going on? Can I figure out the psychology? And as I read more and more, it became clear to me that it wasn't that I had errand paralysis, which was a dorky word that I came up with to talk about my inability to go to the cobbler. It was that I was incredibly burnt out. And the reason why I couldn't identify it as such was that I think burnout is so often represented and talked about as this thing, like you work really, really, really hard, you burn out, and then you go on a vacation for a week and you recover and then things are better. But it's something that is very much solvable. That's like, you know, all you need is a little time off in order to fix it. And I had had time off right after the election. I'm very good at purposely taking vacations. But the thing that became clear as well was that it wasn't just about my relationship to work, specifically to my job. It was also about all of these other pressures to do with student loans and social media and trying to, you know, keep track of everything in my household, all of those things. And it expanded into this long essay that was speaking about how millennials specifically live in this time where most of us graduated into or right after the economic downturn. So we have not known financial security, and that is exacerbated by the amount of student loans that we've taken on, either for our undergrad or many of us who graduated into the recession and were like, oh, what can I do? I guess I have to go to grad school. So more loans. But then also the very specific climate of living with social media and with complete availability at all times. So that means not only are you trying to kind of manage what your life looks like through your Instagram, which is its own sort of pressure that I think people don't necessarily understand.
I think it's very much generational.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I learned the phrase FOMO, fear of missing out, like 3 months ago. I go, what is this? And I go, I've never experienced that. I'm sorry, I've never experienced the fear of missing out. Yeah. But it is a thing.
Yes, absolutely. And just trying to, I think what a lot of people that I've spoken to about millennial burnout, that FOMO is part of it, but that is not the biggest thing. Oh. It's more this, like, you look at people's lives and you're like, they seem to have things balanced. They seem to have the balance of family and hustling and working all the time, but then also, like, having leisure, like having a great dog and then, like, a cute home and somehow finding time to, like, bake cupcakes, right? they have it all.
I think this is all a myth.
No, of course, but you see it represented very persuasively when you're on Instagram.
And if you're from a media, a voracious media consuming generation.
Yes.
That makes a difference.
Are. Yeah. And then, you know, our phones and our computers and Wi-Fi, and they facilitate constant availability. So there is no on or off time for many of our jobs, right? It's just always working. And so that lack of a delineation between laboring for money and not laboring for money, like that is really, you don't have time to recover from it. You don't have that leisure as contrast.
See, I think that is a whole workforce trend. And yes. I think it's affecting older people as well as millennials.
Oh, yeah. And this is the thing, you know.
I mean, I think there's a general burnout just between the political culture and this culture of work never ending. You're expected to work at home. You're expected to be available 24/7. You have a phone that's plugged to you, and you have to be available to answer it.
yeah.
one way or another.
Yeah. And things on your phone like Slack, which a lot of workplaces yeah. use for constant availability, or just like responding to emails at midnight in bed. But after the article came out, there was the primary pushback was that, well, I'm a boomer. I'm burnt out too. And absolutely. Like, I think that the thing about millennials is our specific type of burnout is this peculiar accumulation of when we entered into the workplace, the debt, also things to do with healthcare and lack thereof, and the rise of, you know, like freelance hustle culture, and then also social media. Like all of it combines to become a particularly noxious form for millennials. That does not mean that just because you are 41 and on like the young Gen X age that you're not also experiencing that. Or that boomers aren't as well, but they are experiencing it differently, I think. So what I was specifically trying to articulate was what millennial burnout feels like.
So when you wrote that article, you heard from a lot of your peers who said, yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, the exact same
it's
way.
Far and away the most viral thing I've ever written. It's mm-hmm. been read 6 million times.
It sounds like from what I've just read recently, some follow-ups, this could be the next book.
It is the next book. It was just officially announced yesterday, actually. Yeah, and it seemed natural with as much feedback and as I received that there was a lot more there. There's a lot more just in terms of like there are parts of the essay that could be expanded, but also considering another response to the piece, which is that my articulated experience, which, you know, I was trying to write from my own point of view, is very much like a white, educated, upper middle class experience. And some of the follow-ups that we actually published on BuzzFeed were very much looking at how all of these other intersections of identity. So like, what is it like to try to deal with all of these pressures if you're also disabled? What is it like if you're dealing with all these things and you're dealing, like living in a place that you're dealing with systemic racism? Or if you're
endemic poverty.
Yeah, poverty. You know, first-generation college student, first-generation immigrant, all of these different things that make it so that a person accumulates that burnout in a different way.
You've also been writing about college debt. I assume this will be a major part of the book as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've been writing about what you believe is a coming divide between those who have it and those who don't.
Yep.
How do you think that's going to play out, at least at this point?
Well, I think one of the things we're seeing with this current generation, which you don't have to have student debt yourself to know that this generation has taken on so much more debt than any generation before, is that you have people who have kids now, right? So I'm 37, and a lot of my friends are about the same age, have young children. They're still paying off their debt, might not ever pay it off. And what that means is that they are not saving for their children's education either.
So it's a continuing cycle.
So their kids will actually take on more debt, right? Because college costs will only continue to increase, at least if we continue on the trajectory that we're currently on, and they won't have any assistance. You know, so most people I know had maybe just a little bit of assistance from their parents in some way, but that, you know, if you have nothing, if you're still paying off your student debt, like we could foreseeably come to a place where there's like three generations of student debt that is passed on.
One of the things I was struck by that article was you said, you know, college has shifted in society's belief about it. It used to be college was a societal investment because mm-hmm. society was going to benefit from a more educated workforce, a more educated citizenry. That's changed. It's college is now a personal investment, not a societal one.
Yeah. And you look at something like the GI Bill, which, you know, if you are someone whose parents went to college or whose grandparents went to college specifically, they likely had assistance from the GI Bill. It started this lineage of college education amongst incredible swaths of people in this country.
We have to remember, it was only 1946 when we started becoming a more college-educated society.
Yeah, and it was so dramatic, and it was all government-funded. And I think oftentimes, you know, if it's attached to service in some way, specifically military service, then that sort of assistance is still valorized, right? But mm-hmm. if it's somehow disarticulated from military service or from science, because there also was a lot of funding for people who were going to college to become scientists during the Cold War because there was this incredible anxiety about, like, what if we lose to Russia? But that has also gone away. And funding, especially for universities and that are, you know, state institutions, that used to also be part of our mindset, is like part of what we pay taxes for is to fund these institutions so that tuition can stay low so that more people can come. But we have transferred that burden onto the individual now.
Very interesting sidebar on the other area in which society has said we're making an investment, and that's public service.
Yeah.
And you've written about the public service loan forgiveness. A lot of other people have been writing about it as well, that a lot of young people have chosen public service and find 3 or 4 years into that service expecting their loans to be forgiven, but they don't qualify. And a lot of time it's for really technical reasons.
Yeah. So this program, for people who don't know, is basically if you graduate from college or grad school and go into a field that is public service, so that can be teaching, it can be
nonprofits,
yeah, it could be social work, you know, there's a lot of things that fit under this umbrella, that if you make income contingent payments, so a percentage of your income every month, and you do those on time for 10 years, then the remainder of your loan will be forgiven. And the idea is that, like, for many people, you're only, after 10 years, you're really paying off the interest anyway. So it's not as if it's like a huge, huge amount of forgiveness. But also, it's a way to incentivize people going into these lower paying public service jobs. So, you know, if you're a doctor, maybe you should go into public service working with rural populations instead of becoming a surgeon, right?
A plastic surgeon
and making a whole lot of money. Or if you're a lawyer, maybe you should work in public service for a nonprofit or something like that instead of going to New York and working to defend huge companies. You know what I mean? The problem then is that this program, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, has not been really supervised or disciplined. Because the thing is these loan companies, they are for-profit enterprises. They get to make more money if you keep paying off your loans, both in terms of fees and in terms of, you know, accumulating more interest. So it's in their interest for you not to get your loans forgiven. And that to me is just, it's so contradictory that we have companies that want more than anything for you to keep paying off your loans. And then we have people who really are, a lot of people are scraping by trying to make those monthly payments with the hope of, you know, after doing this for 10 years that they could have it forgiven, only to have it extended again and again.
Yeah. It's going to be a really interesting next few years because I think this problem is only going to get worse and worse.
Yes.
Anne Helen Peterson, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Anne Helen Peterson is a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She'll be speaking on Unruly Women to Millennial Burnout, the politics of popular culture in the digital age, this evening at 5:30 in a free lecture at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. Her most recent book is titled Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Reign of the Unruly Woman. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.